So this is a story that I've wanted to tell for a long, long time.
My guest on this week's How to Fall Apart is the author Elizabeth Gilbert. With her book Eat, Pray, Love, Liz Gilbert essentially created a roadmap for anyone whose life goes off the rails and who is forced to remake and rethink everything. Anyone who's read the book or seen the film starring Julia Roberts will know it ended with Liz meeting the man who would go on to become her husband. Now in our interview, she reflects on how the biggest mistake she made was thinking her Eat, Pray, Love journey should only last for a year, and that our lives do not come to tidily packaged conclusions. I'm Leithan Hines, and this is How to Fall Apart. I suppose the first thing I wanted to ask was, it's set in New York in the 40s amongst showgirls, and you've written about women who are promiscuous, and I think you use the phrase sexual abandon. And there are consequences, but they're not broken by their consequences. They kind of survive their choices. You might just tell us a little bit about that.
There is, as we all know, this trope in Western literature of the ruined woman. And it makes for a really great story. Some of my favorite books in the entire world are stories of the ruined woman, Anna Karenina, Emma Bovary, and pretty much everything by Henry James. And we can just go through the list. And yet, as a female reader, there is something so anguishing about reading these stories and about feeling like the wages of pleasure are so violent. And, you know, you could really summarize these stories as nice girl on a good path, keeping it together, had some desire, followed it, one orgasm, dead. Under the wheels of the train. Okay, next one, next victim. You know, and it just feels like, really, guys? You know, is this... I mean, I know that the mores for women have always been very narrow, and yet, if we are to look at actual history, and we are to look at our own histories and the history of all the women who we know, and what we will find is that women are actually quite capable of surviving the consequences of the terrible, terrible choices that we make around sex and love and romance. And if that were not the case, then there would be scarcely a woman left alive in this world, because we all make dreadful choices, and sometimes the consequences are quite severe, and sometimes they're almost comical, but we tend to be able to endure them, not just endure them, but survive them, and not just survive them, but maybe find out later in life in older years that these things seasoned us and turned us into really interesting people. And that's what this book is about. It's a woman in her 90s looking back at her youth, at her reckless sexual abandon, and seeing what it turned her into. And what it turned her into is somebody who I would very much like to be when I'm 90. and that's a story that I feel like I kind of owed it to myself to tell, and to female readers to tell that version of the story.
It's a kind of pushback on shame, isn't it, as well? There's a line where you say, Vivian says, at some point in a woman's life, she just gets tired of being ashamed all the time. And after that, she's free to become whoever she truly is.
Yeah. Yeah, you're Irish, you know a little bit about shame.
A little bit, yeah. I'm familiar with its work.
not to do a thin slice culturally here, but you guys
you're on safe territory there.
Yeah. You know, it's a killer. It's literally a killer. And the greatest depression and anxiety that I've ever experienced in my life has always been around shame. Okay. And certainly around sexual shame, which is shame, some sense of having been a bad person, a bad girl. You know, there's a line in the book where Vivian, it takes her until middle age to realize this, as it has also taken me, that you don't have to be a good girl to be a good person. You know, there's something that's wrapped up so much around desire and yearning and longing and failure that will, that somehow is like the, you would be, you know, they'll have you believe that this is your entire moral, ethical essence as a human being, and it's bullshit. It's simply not true. And it's, but it does a number on you as long as you continue to believe in its existence. And you know, one of the things, shame and blame have a lot in common. They're kind of a ping-ponging that we do with ourselves and other, right? We're constantly in this dance of shame and blame and shame and blame. And trying to pass this hot potato back and forth to each other. It's your fault. Oh, it's my fault. Yeah. I did it. I'm history's greatest monster. No, wait a minute. You're history's greatest monster. You know, we're just doing this thing back and forth. It's just such a brutal experience to mm-hmm. be in the dance of shame and blame. But here's an interesting exercise that I do sometimes when I'm feeling shamed and blamed, or I'm feeling shame or blame mm-hmm. about someone else, which is, imagine that you walk into a forest and there's a moss-covered boulder in the mm-hmm. middle of the forest, and you stand in front of it. And you shout at it, "I blame you. It is all your fault. You should be ashamed of yourself." Witness the reaction of the boulder mm-hmm. to those words. And is anything actually happening to it? Yeah. Like, does it alter it in any way whatsoever? The mm-hmm. boulder is real. Mm-hmm. The boulder is real and tangible. If you touch it, you can feel it. It's a mm-hmm. real thing. Your voice is real and tangible. It makes sound mm-hmm. and vibration. And mm-hmm. like the birds might turn their head and be like, "What the hell's going on?" You know. But the blame and the shame are mm-hmm. nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you understand yeah. that there's actually nothing to it?
Yeah.
If I were to ask you to put your shame and blame in my open hand that I'm yeah. holding in front of you right now, mm. you couldn't. Mm. Because you could put your hand on my hand. Mm. You're real. Mm. I'm real. Mm. But shame and blame are invented. It's literally imagination. Mm. It's literally mm. an imagined thing that you and I, if we decide to shame and blame each other, have agreed to share this dream.
Yeah.
That shame and blame are real, and we've decided to believe that it's real, and we will suffer as much as we decide to continue to believe that this is real. And the second that you go out in the forest and you yell it at a boulder and you try to impact the boulder with it, you will see that it is nothing. Mm. It is nothing but a dream mm. that we're trapped in, mm. and it's a dream that will destroy you mm. if you're not careful.
How did you step out of it?
It's by doing a lot of spiritual work, mm. a lot of spiritual work, that the real spiritual work, the kind that really helps you see the difference between what's imaginary and what's real.
Okay.
And also in recognizing that shame especially, so shame, there's a kind of narcissism in shame. This mm. is what helped me to get out of it and helps me ongoingly to get out of it, is that, like, I can just tell from talking to you and looking at you that you're a compassionate person who doesn't want people to suffer and probably wishes to embody universal human compassion. Am I right about that?
Thank you. Yes.
And am I also right that you assault yourself constantly and brutally take yourself down and never let yourself off the hook, and there's a bunch of stuff you've never forgiven yourself for?
Yes, okay. Definitely.
So your notions of universal human compassion mm-hmm. are faulty mm. because you've okay. excluded yourself from it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So universal human compassion that does not include the self is not universal. There's one major absence, you. You know, and so if you take yourself out of universal human compassion and say, mm-hmm. I'm the only one who's not deserving.
Mm-hmm.
The standards are higher for me.
Mm.
If I were to tell you exactly your story mm. and say, this is what I did, this is where I failed, this is what I did, you would be like, oh, sweetheart, let that
yeah.
go.
Mm.
You would, of course you would, instantly.
Mm.
You'd be like, you've got to let that go. That was years ago. You were young. You didn't know. You did the best you could. My God, you've got to move on from it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look, you're killing yourself. Don't do that. It would be so obvious to you,
mm-hmm.
right? But you don't let yourself off the hook because mm. of the narcissism that you're somehow special.
Okay, yeah.
You're special. So my question to you is, what makes you so very special?
Okay.
That you are not subject to universal human
yeah.
compassion.
Okay.
Only you. Everyone else gets to be forgiven, but not you.
Like, yeah.
That's crazy, and it's yeah. very grandiose.
Yeah.
And what are you waiting for? Mm. When will you stop being so special
mm.
that you actually get to be forgiven? And who are you waiting to give it to you?
Mm.
Because if I were to tell you, you're fine, you're off the hook,
mm.
it wouldn't work.
Mm.
You know, I could tell you that till God comes home,
mm.
and it's not going to work.
Mm.
You know, you've got to believe that in yourself, and I think the only way to believe that is to say, I am no different from anybody else.
Okay.
I am no better than anybody else.
Mm.
I am no worse than anybody else. All of us here are in the same dilemma.
Yeah.
We're all sharing the same dilemma of trying to figure out how to navigate
mm.
human life and how to be an ape with sentience and consciousness, and it's weird, and I don't know how to do it either, but we're all doing our very best, mm. and that's where self-forgiveness comes in, is by
okay.
saying, I do not live by a different standard than I would hold anybody else to.
Okay. The book, you started writing it before the Me Too movement started. What do you think about the conversation around female sexuality now? I know you've talked about consent, but that you feel there's more to that we should be looking at as well.
I just don't want us to forget.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing. I think I'm a giant fan and supporter of the Me Too movement. I think it's a long overdue expression of female rage that needs to have its voice. I also think, as a feminist, it's a kind of incredible moment right now to see that for the first time in my experience, and probably for the first time in Western history, I see that the patriarchy is actually on the defensive rather than feminism being on the defensive. Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah.
That's new. We haven't seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not but, it's and.
Yeah.
And I just don't want the only conversation about female sexuality to be about consent. Mm-hmm. I also want to keep reminding everybody that there is such a thing as female desire that has its own impetus, its own muscular structure, its own darkness, its own urges, that is about a woman standing in her yearning, in her need, looking across the room at somebody and being like, that, I want that, and I'm going to go get that. And there are moments, seasons in a woman's life where she is every bit more predator than prey. And to deny that and to forget about that is to actually not be speaking from a place of equality.
Yeah.
Because it's if we actually want to be serious about our equality, then we have to own our own urges as well.
Yes, take the passivity issue.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and recognize that women are capable of doing all sorts of batshit crazy stuff around sex and romance and love and yearning and desire just as much as men are. And it doesn't take away anything from the conversation that's being had about consent and about rape and about violence, but it also means let's actually keep this conversation equitable at the risk of running into a scenario where we forget and we only see ourselves as prey, because it's actually not true.
Yeah. You have described this book as the intention was like a glass of champagne going down, and it is that. It's so celebratory. But you wrote it in the aftermath of Rhea, your partner, having passed away in January. The book was in August, if I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that. You had been writing the book, and then Rhea had her diagnosis for pancreatic cancer. And you put everything aside, didn't you, to look after her?
Yeah, I dropped my entire life. There are moments, interesting moments that will happen to you in life where a lot of times one of the big questions I think that we're often faced with is, what is my purpose? What am I here for? Interesting use of great tragedy is that sometimes it's like, oh, this is what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Oh, the love of my life has pancreatic cancer. Literally nothing else matters to me anymore. There's clarity, and it's a weird thing because you've been asking for it. Show me my purpose. You didn't want it to be that, but there it is, you know. And so I actually had not started writing the book before Rhea died. I had been researching it for years and gathering material and putting it all together, but I hadn't started writing it. In fact, I had intended to start writing it that spring. I had set aside time, and I was going to write it over that spring and summer, and then she got ill. And then I never could imagine caring about that book again. I didn't care about anything, absolutely anything, except her and taking care of her. After she died, it was interesting. I'm trying to see if I can recreate this feeling. I had been in such darkness, and I had been around so much pain, hers and mine, every kind of pain. It had been such a terrible time.
Because you'd gone into it, I know you've spoken about, with a very clear idea of how you would, the kind of death that you would...
Yeah, I was going to cure it. Yeah. It makes me laugh. I'm sorry to laugh, but it's like a little bit like a parent having a child and being like, I'm going to be great at this.
I heard you make that comparison. Where they're going to fit into my life
like you have so any control of this. I'm going to be so, because I read all the books.
Perfect comparison.
You see, I read all the books.
Yes. We all say that.
This is the beautiful, generous, generous gift of life, is that it will relentlessly correct you. Yeah. It will relentlessly correct you. It will do whatever it has to do to correct you of your delusions. So I went into it being like, I'm going to be the world's greatest caregiver because I love her more than I've ever loved anyone, and that's all it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually, of course, not true. As anybody who's a caregiver knows, it will grind you.
Yeah.
It will pulverize you. into dust. And there's also the inconvenient thing of how that person behaves.
Yes, they have agency within it.
Where she refused to play the role of the perfect patient. Yeah. I was like, you're not making my movie right.
Yeah. How can I be Florence Nightingale?
Exactly. Like, but Rhea was so, for her entire life, it's why I loved her. She was so such an iconoclast, and she was so completely uncooperative. She was like, I'm not your story, bitch. I'm not going to like make your story beautiful. I'm going to do it what I've always done, which is exactly what I want, even if it destroys me and everyone around me. Like, this is the energy that was Rhea, you know. So I was humbled, and I was beaten down, and I was broken and heartbroken and devastated, and all of it that happens with being in an experience like that. Something, I don't know what. I mean, God, I am just so grateful for the creative urge that I've always had in me. That's always been so life affirming and life saving. But something in me, very shortly after her death, knew that the best possible thing that I could do for myself was to now write this very light, very giddy, very life-affirming, very joyful story.
Yeah.
It did. It rebalanced the scales in a way.
Yeah.
Also, I will say this. I'm just thinking of this right now. I haven't thought of this before. Being a novelist, I could make characters who I could actually control, which was not what I was able to do when I was dealing with Rhea and with her family and with our what we were struggling. You know, I couldn't control anything, but I couldn't control life or death or anyone or myself. Mm-hmm. And so there was something very soothing for me about going back to, this I can actually create and I can have it begin and end just how I want it to. Mm-hmm. And there was something very healing about that. And I have found, as much as it helped me and made me feel so much better, I will say that the second year of my grief has been a great deal harder than the first. Yeah. And I think that's true for a lot of people.
I think that is,
It's not as simple to get over as you might think. But I did have a really great time writing that book.
Yeah.
And it did remind me of who I am and what I can do. You know, part of being a caregiver is that you just become so subsumed by the person that you're taking care of that you kind of forget your own self, your own path, your own joy.
Yeah.
So I would recommend writing a frivolous novel about 1940s showgirls to anybody who's having a hard time.
You brilliantly describe the difference between grief and depression and how depression can sometimes come about because emotions are not being dealt with and they can kind of calcify, I think, and that can cause depression, which is kind of an absence of feeling. It's a blocking.
Right.
But you spoke about how that had happened to you in the past.
Yeah.
Around the time when you then went and wrote Eat, Pray, Love, and at this time you were really determined to feel everything in the aftermath of Rhea's passing.
Yeah, it's I have my friend Martha Beck, who's a great teacher and writer, says, I will feel anything that I need to feel in order to avoid depression.
Because that's what it is sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's you're too scared to feel.
Yeah, you think it will kill you, but actually the depression will kill you. Mm. It can literally kill people.
Yeah.
So for me, the most uncomfortable feelings were not necessarily... See, I was very surprised at how much rage there was in grief.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because I think that rage and anger can be difficult for women. We're not taught how to deal with it in a way that we feel we're being kind of hysterical or out of control, or we're not given kind of roadmaps on how to.
I was raised by Midwestern Scandinavians, Lutherans. You try finding rage. You know, it's like it's even worse. You know, culturally, it's not just gender. It's also just the culture that I come from.
And you thought that wasn't part of your grief. You said in the month.
I thought grief would look a certain way.
Yeah, sure.
And again, life is a beautiful, beautiful friend in showing you what things actually are.
Yeah.
Not what you dreamt them to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that grief would look like just a lot of weeping.
Yeah.
And a lot of loneliness. And to my surprise, I was in a blaze of rage. Mm. I was in a blaze of rage for months after Rhea died.
Mm.
And it was incredibly uncomfortable.
Mm.
And it, you know, there were people who were who I was targeting. You know, there were people whose behavior during her death I had found to be appalling, and they were the center of my, I could not shake. So I wasn't even thinking about Rhea, you know, I was like, these people failed, you know, and I was, there was some rage at Rhea, for some of the behavior that that she had, that I felt that she had robbed herself and me of this precious time that we should have been spending loving each other, and her own rage at dying had had metastasized and made her very hard to be with, and I was enraged at her about that. I was like, you stole my purse. You stole my person. I only had you for 18 months and you stole it. You know, I had such an immature understanding. It's, I don't say immature in a cruel way to myself. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know. And I had rage at God for taking the only person in the world who I ever felt like I could not live without. I was like, you can take, I have a whole list of other people who you can take. Why did you take this one? Donald Trump is alive and Ray is dead. What the actual fuck are you up to? You know, and rage at myself for mistakes that I felt that I'd made. And and I, here's what I didn't get. I kept, and rage at the rage for existing and for keeping me so uncomfortable. And I remember this moment where I just thought, I was writing in my journal and I said, this is so, this rage has to go away so that I can grieve. Because this rage is an interruption of my grief. And it was in that moment that the scales fell from my eyes and I was like, oh, this is your grief. This is your grief. This is what it looks like. You're grieving. You are grieving. And this is how it looks for you right now. There's no template. You know, there's the stages of, of grief. They're all, that's all true, but they're not in order.
There's no tidy little progress through the five. No,
you will have all of them, but they are not in order.
Yeah.
And they will sometimes be all at the same time.
Yes.
And and you might not get all of them. You might get four of them, but really hard. You know, there's no, we just do what humans do, which is try to make order out of things so that we can feel more comfortable. And in fact, there just isn't any. There just isn't any, and surrendering to the powerlessness of that is actually the threshold into peace.
Yeah, you've described how, I mean, you can think you're done with grief, but you're not done until it's done with you, and how you can get just even a second's notice, and you described it as a bow down when it arrives, that you just have to submit to that.
Yeah, you do. That feeling. You know, there's a meditation teacher who I love recently taught me this. I don't think she invented it, but she clarified it for me, where she said depression is the lowest energy, it's the lowest vibration, it's the lowest, it's almost dead. There's nothing going on, and it's a complete shutdown. And you can transcend depression by allowing yourself to feel fear and sadness and dread. Right, depression is a refusal to feel fear and sadness and dread. So if you can allow yourself to feel that, you'll actually weirdly get out of depression. But now you're in fear, sadness, and dread, which is really uncomfortable. So you can transcend, it's a process, but you can transcend fear, sadness, and dread by allowing yourself to feel lust and rage.
Okay.
These are higher vibrations.
Yeah.
So like you just keep going.
There's an energy to them.
There's an energy to them that will actually, you can get out of your sadness a lot of times by feeling rage. But now you're in rage, which is really uncomfortable. Like really, really uncomfortable.
Scary as well.
And scary. Yeah. I mean, talk about being taken captive by something. I mean, I felt that I was a complete hostage to it. You can, now she said the only vibration that's higher than rage is pride.
Oh, right.
You know, your pride is actually like the only thing that's actually stronger and higher than rage. And then there is only one thing that can transcend, get you out of pride, because pride is very uncomfortable too.
Yeah.
There's only one thing that can get you out of pride, and that is courage.
Okay.
And namely, it's the courage to admit that you are powerless.
Yeah.
And that is the threshold to peace.
Yeah.
That is the threshold to peace. And you wouldn't think it, but the courage to admit powerlessness is actually the exact opposite of depression.
Yeah.
Because depression can feel powerlessness, but you're actually not even experiencing powerlessness because you won't let yourself.
No, you're still controlling.
Because you're still controlling.
Yeah.
So the last thing is just, I am powerless over all of this.
Yeah.
I am powerless over all of this. And weirdly, that is when you begin to relax.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't seem like it would. It's when you've let like the last fingernail let go of the cliff that you've been holding on to, that you're trying to just survive and cope. It's like the opposite of coping.
Exactly.
It's just letting go.
Yeah, because coping becomes this badge of honor that you think you've got control and you're like, it's all shit, but I'm coping, but actually what's going on?
Doing real well. Yeah. Doing really well. Yeah, really, why can I see your neck tendons from across the room? Why haven't you blinked in 4 minutes?
Can't turn your neck, but you're coping. Good work. Good you.
Yeah. Good coping. Really good coping.
You have given some really good kind of tips, I don't know is the word, for people who are grieving, and you've talked about a few of the things that you've done, one of which is that you talk to Rhea, but in a really specific way, by leaving messages on your phone.
Yeah. I started doing this shortly after she died. I missed talking to her so much, so I would would press the voice record message on my phone, and I would leave her, like, I would call her. But it's just my voice record message on my phone.
Yeah.
But there's something about the fact that it was being recorded that made me feel, this is my magical thinking, it made me feel that it was being received.
Yeah.
Because it was being recorded, something was taking it in. Mm-hmm. So it's very different from just speaking to the empty air, where I felt like there was a void. So it helped me feel like I could manage the void. Mm. Here's a portal, you know, to talk to Ray.
Yeah.
And I would take the dog for a walk in the woods, and I would just put the headphones on, and I would call her.
Okay.
And I would talk to her the whole time I was walking. Mm. And I would tell her everything that was going on, and what was happening with all our friends, and what I was feeling. And it made me feel better. Mm. It really made me feel better.
Mm.
And I did that really for a very long time. And then I started to feel like she was talking back, that if I would ask a question to her about what I should do, because the reason I always say that she was the person I couldn't live without is that she was the person whose advice was always what I needed.
Yeah.
And I always knew that if I went to Rhea, she would tell me what to do and she would be right. And that there was something so safe about that.
Mm.
You know, this is the person who's going to tell you exactly what to do, exactly what to say. And if I couldn't do it because I didn't have the courage, she would love me anyway.
Yeah.
There was the two things there that were both really critical. So when I was in a dilemma, I would ask her what to do, and then I would wait. So a lot of those messages, it's an hour-long message of me talking to Ray, and you know, 40 minutes of it is silence. 40 minutes of it is just me listening. And eventually what would happen is I feel like I either heard her voice, or it would be an image would drop into my mind that would be the answer, you know, a memory, where I felt like she was showing me, it's like this time, remember when I told you this, and so I would be able to access that. And I don't know what that is. I don't know whether that's actually her speaking to me, guiding me, or whether it's my imagination when I'm grieving needing me to fill in so that I don't feel so alone. It's like a survival mechanism in my imagination to take away that sense of the void, or it could just be that I knew her so well and that I really, in the 17 years that I loved her, and that she was my best friend and my person and then my lover, I really downloaded her wisdom so that it's braided into my own consciousness now, so that actually I don't have to live without her.
Yeah.
Because I have it all now.
Yeah.
All of it, everything that she had to give me is now mine. So I don't know. I don't know if it's mystical. I don't know if it's psychological. I don't know if it's...
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. And I have also stopped doing it very recently, because I felt like now I have to just do this myself.
Okay, so you're at that next stage where you get a little bit stronger.
I guess so, yeah.
I think that's sometimes why the second year is harder, because...
Yeah. The magical thinking. I kind of like, I think I might have to let go of this.
Yeah,
it might be holding me back now.
But I think that's, you're getting stronger in a way, that you're able to take on board stuff that maybe you weren't. You also have spoken about how you dance and you listen to music, that helps enormously.
Yeah, I dance every day. I danced this morning in this very hotel. and it's really essential because, you know, people like us forget that we have a body because we are just a head in a jar on a broomstick, and we carry that broomstick around with the jar head in it. to the next problem that we put ourselves in front of. And like, that's kind of how we go through the days. They're so in our heads. And it's very easy to actually forget that there's also this thing. There's also this body. And grief, I think, can settle in your body.
Oh, it's very physical.
Like a virus. And feels like a virus. My experience in the first few months of grief was feeling like I had a very bad flu. It just, like, I just didn't have any energy. And I was like, God, it's weird. I don't feel sad, but I just, walking up these stairs, I'm out of breath. You know, there was, it's just a weight. And so I felt like dancing was a way to reverse that. And it's also a way to move emotion through you. You know, movement is a way to shift, shift your literal energy. So yeah, it's been really good. I would never not do it again. Oh, that's what it is. Something's rattling. It's my big giant ring. I was like, what is that noise? I have this big giant pimp ring that I'm wearing. I put it on a piece of glass and it's jiggling about. What is that odd noise? As usual, it's coming from within me. I dance and I just hit shuffle. And I, at the beginning, I would say, it was also a way to connect to Ray. I would say, you pick it.
Okay.
You pick it. And so whatever she would pick that day,
What's her favorite song, a Van Morrison song?
What's that?
Van Morrison.
So then that happened. Yeah. I mean, that also, I am really trying this year to sort of have a little bit less magical thinking, because I feel like I'm needing to be more grounded. But sometimes things happen that are just inexplicable in the rational world. And what happened is that I went to her cremation with her ex-wife, the two of us, and we had been taking care of her when she was dying, and it had gotten very, very beyond close. I mean, it's a bond that there is no word for. And Rhea had been very frightened. One of the things she was very frightened of was to be left alone in her body after she died. She just, because she didn't know where she was going, and she didn't know what was going to happen, and she didn't want to be alone. And so I promised her that I would stay with her as much as I could with her body. And to me, that promise meant I also went with her body to be cremated. I felt like I had to. I couldn't just have strangers do that. And Gigi came with me, and while she was burning, which takes a long time.
It takes hours and hours for a body to burn.
It's a lot. We are made of a lot of substance. And it takes a huge flame. I mean, it's such an incredible metaphor for what it takes to be free. You know, it takes such an enormous amount of power. It's actually very environmentally correct. I've learned since that it takes approximately as much fuel to burn a body as it would take to fly a jet plane across the continental United States.
You're joking.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's...
So I'm sorry, planet, but on the other hand, it was Rhea. It was Rhea, and it was her last flight. And it was worth it. But we were just sitting there in silence in this weird warehouse in suburban Detroit, just praying and meditating and being with her in that experience. And my phone was in my purse next to me on the floor, and all of a sudden it started to play Rhea's favorite Van Morrison song.
Can I ask what song it is?
Yeah, I'm having trouble remembering the title, but it's the one that goes, "Oh, the water."
Oh, yeah.
The water.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Oh, the water, as she's burning. Let it rain on down on me.
Wow.
And it stoned me.
It stoned me. Yes, of course.
It stoned me just like going home.
Yeah.
As she's burning. And it's never happened. I've had this phone for years. It's never, we were in silence.
There's no Siri in your phone, isn't it? Yeah.
Just happened.
Yeah.
I'm getting like full body chills again from it, because it was so incredible. Like, what is that? And it's also great. Of course, I'm laughing that I forgot the title. Rhea had been a heroin addict and a massive drug user for a good part of her life. She'd been sober for years when I met her, but of course she would go out too, and it stoned me. So we just started dancing.
You and Gigi?
And laughing and crying, and we were dancing in front of her furnace while she burned to that song. And it was so interesting, because the guys who run the crematorium, they'd never seen anyone come in there.
Okay, wow.
And really? and they were so sweet. I mean, I would have thought, I guess because it's Michigan and like there's a more innocence, I would imagine in New York they'd be like, no, you can't be here. Like lawsuit, like liability, like but something, you know. Like, and we just said, we want to be here. And they were like, well, wow, we've never had anybody ask for that before. But they brought us these two folding chairs. They were so kind. And they were going about their business. They had lots of other stuff to do. And we sat there for 5 hours in their workspace. Wow. And later they said, and at one point we asked them to open the door so that we could see. Mm-hmm. And it had been several hours by that point. And I will say this, I know this, I will never see anything in my life more beautiful than what I saw. To see her in flame. And it was at that point she was a skeleton, and she was just surrounded by white, hot, blue, purple, and gold flame. And I said to Gigi, she's never looked more like herself. Mm. I mean, that's how I always saw Rhea. Mm. She always had that much energy, that much power, that much fire. And it was so exquisite to see her turning from one substance into another. Mm. And she looked, Gigi said she looks like a Viking king. Yeah. You know, and she was a Viking king in the world as well. Yeah. It was so magnificent. And we took turns praying, we meditated, we chanted, we danced, we cried. That 5 hours, if we had not done that, I don't know what state we would have been in, because the funeral was so cold and awful in a way. And we had a memorial for her later in New York that was more spirited and more like Rhea, but was awful in its own way. That 5 hours was so holy and so sacred. And when we left, the guy said, it's one of the most beautiful things we've ever seen.
Really?
You know, they're like, who are you? What are you doing? We're like, oh, we do shit like this all the time, man. Like, and I do feel like, you know, one of the things I've always said is that you get to make up your own ceremonies.
Yeah.
If the cultural ceremonies that you were raised with no longer work for you.
Yeah.
And this is often the case when people are recovering from religion.
Mm.
If you came from a religion that you no longer can believe in and that no longer works for you, that's great for you to leave. But now you're missing, there's a void, the bass notes are gone of something that's very important for a human to be healthy.
Yeah.
And so if you take that away but don't replace it with anything, it might make you very sick. So you are allowed, in fact, I think it's essential that you get to create your own ceremonies.
Yeah.
And I do that all the time, and my friends and I do that all the time. We're always making up ceremony. Humans need it. So that, I felt like, was how Gigi and I made up our own ceremony.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Can you tell me about Rhea and the quality of mercy that she
I would love to. So, as I say, Rhea was a junkie.
Mm-hmm.
And not just a drug addict, as her nephew and I were once laughing about Rhea, like, there's some nice addicts. She wasn't. All that power, all that force, all that will, all that charisma, when she was in her addiction, made her into a truly bad person, a bad person who did bad things to people, to good people. Who used people and abused people and used everything. She's a user, hustler, a liar, a thief, a felon. And she used to say to me, you don't know what it's like to know that you're a bad person until you manage to convince the prison warden to let you out of jail for a 2-day stay to mercy stay to go visit your father who's dying of cancer. And while you're there, you steal his car and sell it. Okay. She's like, don't come to me with your stories about bad things you did. I got you. I will defeat you in the bad things that you did. And as part of her recovery, as part of anybody's recovery, you have to make amends for the bad things that you did. And you have to stop being a liar. You can't be an addict, and you can't get over, not cure, but recover from your addiction without becoming truth teller. And she became a truth teller and then had to go to people who she had very grievously harmed and ask for their forgiveness, and in many cases they gave it to her, not in all. It was interesting, a couple months before she died she wrote a letter to an ex-girlfriend and said, I only have a few months to live, and I just want to tell you that I love you so much, and I hope that your life is full of peace and joy, and this girlfriend wrote back, "You are history's greatest monster," basically, oh, to a woman on her deathbed.
Wow.
"You are horrible," like a 5-page, and I was like, whoa.
God.
But actually, I know what Rhea was like when she was an addict.
You'd never met her when she was not addicted.
Well, I got to meet her because when she went on opioids for cancer, she went back into it. And I had a lot more sympathy for that ex-girlfriend at that point. I was like, yeah, I see your point. And you had years of this. I gotcha.
How did you meet her? Was it when she cut your hair?
Yeah.
And said you had an Art Garfunkel haircut?
Yeah, my Art Garfunkel hair. I had such a bad blonde fro. I looked so stupid. And she was so captivating, but what Rhea learned in that was, you know, she used to say, "Mercy is what I owe," because I was given it by so many people who didn't need to, and maybe shouldn't have, and people who should cross the street when they see me coming actually forgave me, and she became somebody who had such capacity for mercy. Mm. Interestingly, she also had mercy for herself.
Okay,
right? You also can't heal from your addiction unless you find mercy for yourself. Mm. Because all addiction is rooted in shame. Mm. So she actually found absolution and forgiveness for herself. And so that is why that she could express mercy toward other people. Mm. Because she never excluded herself from it.
Okay.
So if you're projecting mercy on other people and you have no sense of mercy for yourself, that's martyrdom.
Yeah.
That's martyrdom. That is actually not mercy. That's codependence. That's martyrdom. And that will end poorly for everybody. And what Rhea had were these exquisite boundaries where no one could roll over her. But she also never judged anybody. So she would send you out of her room. Mm. And she would even sometimes send people out of her life, but never out of her heart. Mm. So she would be like, okay, you're not a safe person for me to be around now.
Okay.
You have to go.
Mm.
I love you. Mm. Come back when you're not an asshole, and I'll always love you. Like, that's mercy, actually. That's actually mercy. It's mercy for the person, too.
Yeah.
And that's what I learned at her feet, was what real mercy is. And she had such a titanium spine, but I feel like real mercy does. Mm. Fake mercy, what do they call it? Oh, God, the Dalai Lama has a word for it. The Buddhists have a word for it. Idiot compassion.
Oh.
Idiot compassion is, I'm so weak. I want you to love me. Mm. I'm so afraid. I'm going to forgive you even though you're abusing me.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm just going to now let you do whatever you want to me because this is my version of being nice and being compassionate. That's idiot compassion.
Yeah.
That does not change or save anybody. Mm. And as another teacher of mine, Byron Katie, says, the first time someone punches you, that's their violence. The second time, that's you using them to punch you.
Okay.
That's you using somebody to hit you. Because it's what you believe that you deserve. Mm. And being kind to that person and forgiving them and letting them come back and hit you is idiot compassion.
Mm.
You know, mercy, which stands in real grace and an inclusion of everyone, right? Mm. Highest good for everyone, says, oh, actually, no, this is over. No, I don't let people hurt people. Mm-hmm. I'm a person.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually really bad for you also.
Mm.
So no more.
Yeah.
This ends now. That's actual mercy. Mm. That's actual mercy. And Rhea taught me that. No one had ever taught me that before.
Okay.
I'd seen a lot of idiot compassion. and I'd seen a lot of people with what looks like very firm boundaries, but it's actually just rage.
Yeah.
So I'd seen a lot of really tough people, and I'd seen a lot of really squishy people. Mm. So the tough people had really hard boundaries, and they were really badass, but their hearts were fists.
Mm.
And then the soft, squishy people were, like, constantly getting bulldozed, and they were just trying to be nice and sweet, and they were getting run over all the time. Rhea was the first person I ever met who actually contained both in the right order, so that's why everyone in the room was safe when she was in the room, including her.
I wanted to ask you about that, about the idea of safety, because you have spoken about Rhea as someone who, like you just said there, you also mentioned your friends as a place of safety.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's taken me years to figure this out. I used to not tell the truth very much. Certainly when I was a kid and when I was in my 20s, I lied a lot.
Mm.
And it was out of safety, sense of safety.
Yeah.
I was trying to create a safe place.
Yeah.
And that's it, what lying is that you're trying to protect your own safety.
Mm.
It's taken me till this age to realize that you don't wait till the world is safe to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You tell the truth and then the world becomes a safe place. That's how you make the world safe. It's how you make your world safe,
mm-hmm.
is by telling the truth. And I feel safe whenever I'm in a room where people are telling the truth.
Yeah.
And I feel very unsafe whenever I'm in a room where people are not telling the truth. Mm. So my friends are that for me. And I don't have any friends. Sorry, I'm opening it.
No.
I'm just live tweeting to the listeners what's happening here with these sound effects. I'm opening up a bottle of water now. I'm drinking it with my giant ring. Yeah, so I can't be in the room with dishonesty anymore.
Yeah.
Even if I'm alone.
Okay.
Clarity, I think real clarity is when you stop deceiving yourself.
Yeah.
You know? And I'll always know when I am because I start to get sick. I start to get sick and unwell and unhappy and depressed. And I'm like, where am I lying?
Yeah.
Where am I lying? Why is this happening? Why am I so unwell in myself?
And can you usually figure it out by yourself? Or are there...
My friends will help me.
Okay.
I mean, they hold up a mirror. It takes a while, but I'm pretty... I have a real allergy at this point to being miserable. Mm. So if I'm... I have a very low tolerance for it. So if I'm miserable... Mm. I'm like, what's going on?
Okay.
And actually, truly, 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 I will tell you that the real question is, what am I lying about?
Okay.
So am I lying that I'm happy in this relationship?
Mm.
Am I lying that this is where I want to be in doing this job right now? Am I lying that this friendship is nourishing? Am I lying the ultimate lie that there's something wrong with me, I'm unworthy.
Okay.
That I'm not deserving of love and compassion. Am I lying about that?
Mm.
That's the final frontier. That's the big lie. That's the big, big, big lie.
You've described Eat, Pray, Love as a book that kind of gave people permission to admit when maybe, you know, I guess stop lying to themselves and admit when things are not right and to examine that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to think... I like to think that I'm just a big walking permission slip.
I take it. It's a nice thing to be.
Really do. Yeah. You know, like, whatever it is, like, I like to give people, like, try to help people find their own permission. Of like, you have permission to create something.
Mm-hmm.
You have permission to leave. You have permission to change.
Mm-hmm.
You have permission to try something. And you have permission to fall in love. You have permission to fall out of love.
Yeah.
Like, if my life... can do nothing else, like, let it just make other people feel better about how weird their own lives are. How, you know, because if, like, look, if you happen to be somebody who has spent your life doing what you were taught and told, and that has made you happy, then you have what I like to call not a problem. So good on you. And you're very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're somebody who has spent your life trying to do what you were taught and told and it has made you deeply unhappy, come and sit with me and we'll talk about that because I know that feeling very, very well.
You described how you had to read back on Eat, Pray, Love to write a foreword at the 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
And there was a scene in Italy where you kind of said something like, I know I'm taking a, you know, I know I've gone off the path now. I will go back, but let me just enjoy this. And how it really struck you that your voice in it was kind of almost apologetic.
Completely apologetic and ashamed.
Yeah. Which you are not like that now, you know.
No.
You realized how much you,
God.
Yeah,
I mean, I look back at that young woman and I'm like, who are you apologizing to and for what?
Yeah.
You know, and what I, and what I had said in that passage was, it was right in the middle of this incredible meal that I was having that I was enjoying. And I was like, it was one of the first days where I felt like completely free of depression.
Mm-hmm.
And instantly I felt apologetic.
Yeah.
And what I felt apologetic about was, I know I fucked up. I know I'm supposed to be married.
Mm.
I'm 35. I know I'm supposed to be married. I'm supposed to have a house and I'm supposed to have children. I know that's where I should be at this time. And that didn't work. And I promised that I will go back to being, I even said, I mean, it makes me wince and it gives me hives, but I think I said something in that passage like, I promise that soon I'll be a respectable person again, but just give me this, just give me this meal, just give me, not quite yet, not quite yet, let me do this yet. And I'm like, oh my God, the only really big glaring error that I see in Eat, Pray, Love is that, is this idea that I still had this absolute fallacy that I owed it to somebody, to anybody, to self, to other, to culture, to family, to who, readers, I don't know, who I was even talking to, that I owed it to recreate and reassemble what would look like a respectable life that would make other people and me feel more comfortable about me. And I was like, that is such bullshit. It's unbelievable. Mm. You know, I will say that the only mistake that I made in Eat Pray Love was to stop going. Like, I ended it after a year. I was like, okay, you got your year.
Yeah.
Now go be, you know, and that's what I went and did. Mm. I went and got married and I bought a house and I became a respectable person again.
Mm.
You know, and I don't regret those years. Those are beautiful years. Mm. But why did I have that idea that that's exactly what I needed to do?
Mm.
The groundwater is so infused with these ideas about what you're supposed to look like at certain periods of your life. And it takes radical awakening to get on the other side of that.
Yeah. I loved that about Vivian, that as the book unfolds, her female friendships are as important as any romance that's in her life.
Yeah, more, I would say.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah. And I thought that was because exactly what you said, for women, we're shown that this is what the ideal situation and ending and the happy ever after and that. I loved that the relationships were...
Yeah, that was her core. Those were her core.
Yeah.
That was what kept her sane and safe and provided her with family, with nourishment, with emotional connection. I mean, the book is obviously a lot about sex and desire, but I would hope, and I'm so glad you caught it, you know, what the real message is in that book is ultimately it's a book about female friendship.
Yeah.
And how essential it is.
Yeah. I loved when you were talking about the Bechdel test and how it's kind of halfway through the book before two men have a conversation together.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant. That was brilliant.
Yeah, there are men in the book, but they don't. They're not that important. I mean, you know, they're fun characters. I love the character of Billy Buell. Yeah. He was so much fun to write. I always love writing somebody who has no morality at all. Because it just, you can just do.
Yeah, he was
fabulous. Just be delightful because he doesn't care.
Yeah.
He's kind of the trickster figure. And the trickster is such a wonderful mythical figure. Mm. And we don't, Christianity has done its best to get rid of it because there isn't a trickster in the Bible unless it's Jesus, who actually sort of does play that role, who comes in and turns everything upside down, literally flips the tables upside down. Anyway, it's fun to write a trickster. When you look up the etymology or the history and the mythology of a trickster, as I did once, there's actually something called like gods.com where you can like compare gods from all different cultures, and the trickster god shows up all over the place until Christianity really stamped him out. But it says, you know, there's a chart and it says like the rat, the hare is a trickster in Africa, the fox, the raven, the crow, the monkey, you know, these are all trickster characters. And then it says, are they good or bad, like in that column, good or evil? And it says neither, not so much, maybe doesn't care. And I feel like that's the really fun thing about writing a trickster character. Billy is like, he's benign mostly, but he just really actually just doesn't care.
And there's no shaming him.
There's no controlling him.
Yeah. The last thing, we'll get the message. You've talked about the difference between courage and fearlessness and how you deal with fear, because it's always there when you're creating. And you might just tell us about that and how
fearlessness.
Speak to fear.
I'm not interested in fearlessness because unless you're talking about a fully actualized saint, and you know, I think I've maybe been lucky enough to meet two of those in my life for real, like somebody who's a fully actualized spiritual master. They don't have any fear. Other than that, or like I think of my friend's daughter who has Down syndrome. She doesn't have any fear. Mm. That's pretty cool. Aside from that, for the rest of us, whenever I've encountered somebody who's fearless, they are a psychopath. They are a psychopath. Mm. So I'd rather be courageous, and courageous means I'm afraid, but I'm going to do this anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you talk to the fear, don't you?
Allow
it to be there and exist and
Well, you know how like
that almost quiets it down?
In like early English literature, like 16th century, like the idea of a morality play or like in Vanity Fair, you know how all the virtues and vices are capitalized and they have identity? So there's virtue and there's fear and there's pride and there's envy, and they all have like, they're not traits, they're actually people, and they would be played on stage by people. I think it's actually a very useful thing to do. You can do that in your in the theater of your own mind. Is because it is a theater and it is a play, is to actually personify all of those different characters and then interact with them and have relationships with them. So I spend a lot of time talking to fear.
Yeah.
And just a lot of listening to it, mm. like respectfully, mm. letting it know that it's heard and that mm. it's loved and that it's allowed to be there, mm. that I will never, ever, ever make it leave, that mm. it's part of the family, that you're included. It's incredible how doing that makes fear leave. Mm. All you have to do is say, I will never, ever make you leave. You are so welcome. You are so loved. I have a cozy bed for you. Yeah. You belong to me. You're one of my children. I adore you. And I'm going to write this book now. And somehow that just makes it just quiet right down and mm. go to sleep. But it doesn't leave. It just goes to mm. sleep. Yeah. Until the next time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I know they want to get a picture taken. So yeah. It was such a pleasure. I could talk to you all day.
Oh, so lovely. Thank you.
I'd like to say a huge thank you to Elizabeth Gilbert for today's interview, and to Cormac Kinsella for all his help organising it and making it happen. It was a hugely exciting occasion for Cassie and I, and a big thank you to Cass for, as always, brilliant editing and producing, to my brother for the composition, and to everyone who listened. Thank you so much.